We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime. Well,
thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about all things elections, how elections are supposed to work, how sometimes they don't work the way they're supposed to, and really anything about our electoral system in America, which is, of course, the bedrock of our constitutional republic. So with us today is a guest who's been with us before, Heather Honey, who is the founder of Verity Vote, V-E-R-I-T-Y, Verity Vote. And you can find her reports at her website at veritivote.us. And Heather is an open source investigator. And so, Heather, welcome back. And tell everybody just briefly, what is an open source investigator?
Yeah, open source investigations are just using publicly available sources, publicly available records to conduct investigations. People use open sources to do, intelligence analysis and those sorts of things. From an investigation standpoint, though, it is using, social media, public records, FOIAs, all of those sorts of things that are records that are available to the public to answer questions.
So you've applied this to the election system on a variety of topics, and people can find your reports that you have completed at your website at veritivote.us. And I certainly urge people to go because there's a lot of really amazing work in those reports. But today I want you to talk to us about a report that you have just completed and it's just been posted and published on your website. And it is about something called UOCAVA. What is UOCAVA?
UOCAVA is the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. And basically,
That's a federal law.
It is a federal law. And so these folks that are, what's interesting is when you talk about that, you see, on election night, the media and even election officials say, oh, we're waiting for the military vote. We're waiting for the military vote. So early on, we were waiting, years and years and years ago. It was limited. These accommodations were exclusively for the military. But of course, it was expanded to include people who are not military, who are just overseas citizens. So the UOCAVA covers military and non-military folks.
Overseas citizens, people who live abroad but want to vote in U.S. elections. And so how does that process, so we'll set aside the military for a moment. Well, actually, before we do that, I will tell you that in my experience over the last couple of decades, my understanding had always been that the overseas non-military component of that of the UOCAVA vote, the non-military was a fraction of the military vote. But your research says that has changed. Talk about that for a moment.
Sure. So military was always the much larger group of that. And if you look at 2012, even in 2012, the majority of these UOCAVA ballots were from the military. But in 2016, that started to flip, and it was a higher percentage of non-military. So it was a higher percentage of overseas citizens who are not military that were voting using these UOCAVA privileges. And in fact, when you look at the numbers for 2020, it was actually 63% not military. 63% not military, 37% military. So again, we're talking these UOCAVA ballots, everybody in their mind, the military, it's largely not military. So
Certainly, that's true. So what you're saying is anymore, it's not the military, it's the civilian. It's the civilian component that is, and that's what we're talking about here today, is the civilian component of the Yukawa vote. So tell us, how do people, just generally speaking, how can someone living abroad vote in a U.S. election? How? What's the process?
Yeah, so the process is, and again, let's like differentiate here a little bit. So if you're a member of the military, you can be anywhere in the world. You can be, if you live in Phoenix, Arizona, but you happen to be stationed in Dallas, Texas, you can vote Yukawa. I mean, that's your privilege as a you know, person in the military. Non-military Yukawa benefits are only for people who are overseas. You may not use, you're not eligible to vote Yukawa if you are not military and you are not overseas. So for the purposes of our research, we said, okay, you know what, anybody who's in the military, they're off the, you know, they're fine. We are, you know, those numbers match up, everything looks fine. So we only really focused on these overseas non-military folks that were registering and voting. So in order to do that, your question was, how do they do that? And there is a document, it's called the Federal Postcard Application, and you can download that. It's on, you know, it's available on multiple different websites, and states put links up to make it available to folks who are citizens. And what you do is you fill in your information on there. You put your overseas address, your mailing address in whatever foreign country you happen to be in. You put your name and your date of birth. And then if you have a driver's license, you're supposed to include that. If you don't have a driver's license, you can include your social security number, last four digits. But if you don't have that either, you can just say, I don't have either. And
then what do you give if you don't have, if you don't put your driver's license or the last four digits of your social security number, if you don't put either of those, what do you put?
Nothing.
Nothing.
You say, I do not have either, and the states must register you. They must. Right.
So that's,
again, these are military.
This, I know, it's nonsense. We're talking just civilians. So
right.
Everybody forget the military. They're dealt with a different way. Mm-hmm. But so anybody in anywhere in the world could simply download that form, say, I'm a U.S. citizen, and, you know, I don't have a driver's license, I don't have a social security number, and they can register to vote in the yes. U.S. election?
Yeah. And it's even more, you know, again, you know, we look for things that could be exploited. We look for vulnerabilities. And this is just absolutely alarming. So if you don't have any association with an address, so let's say, for example, 15 years ago, I lived in Miami, right? And I haven't lived there since. I have to put a U.S. address, right? So they can figure out what precinct I'm in and all of those sorts of things. So you can put your old address, even if that address is no longer there, right? If you have no association with it. So sometimes, you know, you have people looking at the voter rolls and they're like, they have like, you know, eight people living there and that person doesn't live there. If they lived there 15 years ago, and that was their most recent U.S. address, they can put that in there. If somebody has never lived in the United States, so say you are a citizen because one of your parents was a citizen and you have U.S. citizenship, but you've never stepped foot in the United States, mm-hmm. You can put basically an address of somebody that you know, somebody that you know, maybe if your parents were there 50 years ago, and you want to use, you can put any sort of address. You have to just put some address. And in fact, there was some guidance, and different states do it a little bit differently, but in some states, if you say, hey, look, I don't even have like an address, I don't know what to put, they will register these overseas citizens at a courthouse address or something like that. They'll just use like a, you know, whatever the office is there. But here's the thing. You put in a foreign address, right, which should act as a security, as a verification that, you know, right. But these forms say, I want my ballot delivered by email. you can select email me the ballot, send me the ballot electronically, or mail the ballot. So if I'm an overseas citizen and I use this form, it is a voter registration form and an absentee ballot request form all in one. Every single state must honor it. So if I say email me the ballot and I put my address, like I live in the Vatican, right? I could be in Milwaukee and you email me the ballot and I can vote it and return it.
I don't even really have to be overseas.
No.
And there's no verification to make sure that you are overseas.
There is nothing.
And there's no verification of identity.
No.
And there's no verification of citizenship.
None.
Well, gee, what could go wrong here, right?
Right.
I mean, does anyone see any problems here? Oh my goodness.
There's so many things that they could do. Look, I mean, in 2020, there was a commission put together, the EAC, the FBI.
The Justice Commission.
The FBI, like a whole bunch of people looked at, you know, hey, what are the pros and cons of electronic voting, right? Voting by email. And unanimously, they said, whoa, this is incredibly risky voting, and it should not be used unless there's absolutely no other way to vote. And
yet here we have what?
Here we are.
So tell us, so now you've explained the process and the extreme vulnerabilities. So tell us some of the numbers, the data that you have found in terms of anomalies or problems or et cetera.
Right.
What so happened in 2020?
Yeah. So let's start with just like the overall scale of this thing, right? So in 2020, we had the global pandemic, right?
Right.
The State Department went to extraordinary lengths to repatriate anybody who wanted to come back to the United States. There were restrictions on travel abroad. People weren't going, you know, overseas on, you know, summer vacations or anything like that. I mean, there were restrictions on all of that.
Right.
The State Department, anybody who wanted to come home, if they could not get a commercial flight, if commercial flights had stopped in whatever country they were and they wanted to come home, the State Department made arrangements for flights to go pick these people up. And so, you know, we have some pending FOIAs to try to get a sense of the total numbers. But we've had that one pending for about 9 months with the Department of State, and we've gotten nothing from them.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did a records request because, you know, if you live overseas, you have to, and you're a U.S. citizen, you must file taxes, right? You must file income tax
return.
You must file. Even if you have no income, or if you have only a small amount of income, if you want to say, hey, listen, I don't make enough money to be taxed, you still have to file that. So when we're trying to determine, like, what was the scale, like, what was the magnitude of the repatriation? One of the things that we looked at were these tax returns. And what we found is that from 2016 to 2020, the total number of these individual tax returns filed went down by 800,000.
But you're talking about the tax returns filed by citizens living overseas.
Yes, exactly. The people who are overseas, the total number of tax return filed. So again, this this isn't people, right? This is at least that many people, because if you're married and you file jointly, you know, it could be two, it could be three voters, right? But the number of returns went down by 800,000. So again,
in 2020, it went down by 800,000.
Right. From 2016 to 2020, there was a reduction of 800,000. So you would expect, you know, again, we don't know the total number there, but that's the tax returns. So that's really just to show the magnitude of these overseas citizens, right? U.S. citizens paying taxes from overseas, the magnitude of that. So you would expect that in 2020, with all this repatriation, all of our, like, you know, embassies closed and all of the, you know, government employees who are not military coming home, you would expect to see the total number of UOCAVA overseas non-military go down pretty substantially. But that's not what happened in 2020. In fact, in 2020, the total number of the increase, an increase in overseas citizens voting was 389,000. 389,000 additional, more overseas citizens allegedly voted by through UOCAVA in 2020 when, you know, we were still locked down, we weren't traveling.
As compared to 2016.
So we're compared to 2016.
Going from 2016 to 2020. So the number of tax returns goes down by 800,000. The number of votes cast by overseas citizens, non-military, went up by 300,000.
389,000.
Almost 400,000.
Almost 400,000. And of that 389,000, 268,000 of those were non-military. So remember, you know, like the total number, you know, military, well, I just want to make sure that this is clear. The U.S. military, they can vote UOCAVA from anywhere. As long as they are at least 50 miles from what they call home, they can vote UOCAVA. We're not even talking about them. We're talking about these overseas citizens. So the tax returns, the whole thing, it's just the magnitude of people, the magnitude of the reduction of the U.S. citizen population overseas obviously came down in 2020. So how did the number of people who voted from overseas go up so significantly?
And the percentage of civilians increased dramatically.
Dramatically.
It went, you said it was 63% non-military in 2020. What had it been in 2016 and 2012, just by virtue of comparison?
I don't have those numbers, but I think it was like 54% in 2012 was 54% military in 2012, switched to 37% in 2020. So it was like just a big shift over that like 8-year period.
Right. And so are these, I mean, this is just, I'm just dumbfounded by this, but tell me about, pick a state. What did you look at the state by state breakdown? Because this has to be done at the state and actually, I guess, at the local level as well, right?
Right. So again, we used public records here. We used public records from multiple sources, and this is really important. So I will get to the state thing in just a second, but I just want to share a little piece of information. Okay. So the agency that is responsible for administering UOCAVA, right, the Department of Defense is ultimately responsible. They've created this federal voting assistance program. The whole point of that is to sort of ensure that UOCAVA voting happens, that people are aware of how to vote. And part of the requirement of the law is that the DOD report to Congress after every federal election. So again, this is the agency that is responsible for administration of UOCAVA. They do a report to Congress in 2020. In which they say that that according to their records, 224,000 non-military voters, 224,000 non-military voters voted, right? So just keep that in mind for a second. In addition to that, as you mentioned, every voting jurisdiction, whether it's a county or a municipality or whatever, is also required from the federal law to report on UOCAVA participation in their jurisdiction. So the counties, after every federal election, must complete a survey. It's the EAVS, and it has several questions in there about UOCAVA participation, how many requests they received, how many ballots they transmitted, and so on. And again, it's totally available, public information. You can go download it, look at it. When you take that information that's provided by the individual jurisdictions on what they actually received, on the absolute scale, the magnitude of these UOCAVA ballots that they took in 2020, it's quite different from what the Department of Defense told Congress. In fact, when you take those reports from all of these jurisdictions and you add them together, it turns out that the non-military was actually 573,000 ballots. 573 ballots. Keep in mind that the DOD, in their official report to Congress, said it was 224,000. So that discrepancy from these two federal entities is 349,000 ballots.
Wow.
It's unbelievable that these two agencies that are responsible for this are so off in their reporting.
Wow. That's amazing. That's 349,000 delta between what the Department of Defense reported and what all the localities reported.
Right. And how does the Department of Defense, right, the people responsible for administering the UOCAVA program, how could they be so wrong?
Well,
how could they be so wrong?
You know what? I don't think that they, if I'm an overseas citizen and I can do this postcard, I don't even really need the federal voting assistance program at the DOD. I don't even have to go through them,
It's not, they don't measure who goes through them. They measure all together. They get millions of dollars to do a survey of all of the military and all of the overseas citizens. They get millions of dollars and they say, okay, in this subset, they have this whole algorithm that they use to determine the participation. They are, you know, their performance, right? The performance of this agency is based on the participation rate, right? They are trying to drive participation of our military. They're trying to drive participation of overseas citizens. So, you know, they're going to report the best case scenario that they can substantiate, right? If they say, okay, you know what, it looks like our turnout was X percent, they want to show that their program is effective and that it's working. And they did so in 2020. And they said, look how great this is. We had 224,000 citizens engaged. And that was their best case scenario. And as it turns out, somehow, in the midst of a pandemic, when the population overseas has gone down dramatically, the DOD is blindsided, has no idea that these other 350,000 ballots came out of who knows where. The DOD doesn't even know.
Well, you know, it's just, I mean, it really is quite startling. And
so you had asked about Florida. And just if I could just share those numbers with you.
I asked about the state. And so if you looked at the state by state breakdowns.
Right.
And so, how do you get the data about the states? Is that from the EAC data?
Yeah. So the EAC data is actually broken down by jurisdiction. So if you just load it all together and put it in a pivot table and just say, show me all of the numbers for for Pennsylvania, show me all of the numbers and you break it down by state, you can get the state by state totals.
I see. And so you mentioned Florida. So tell us about Florida.
Yeah. So Florida was one of the four states that had the biggest increase in the number of these overseas non-military UOCAVA. So just as a for example, in 2016, Florida received 28,000 across the state, 28,000 non-military UOCAVA ballots, right?
Okay.
In 2020, again, midst of a pandemic, everybody's home, nobody's traveling, it nearly doubled. They got 52,000 non-military UOCAVA ballots in just Florida. So, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Does the state report by category, like for instance, the percentage or the number of votes that were cast for, in this case, for Biden versus Trump?
No, they don't report that. But, you know, we had an opportunity in a couple of places to actually do some hand counts of these ballots, because again, if these ballots are returned either electronically, as some states allow, a lot of states allow you to return it by fax. And so one of the services, interestingly enough, that the Federal Voting Assistance Program offers is that if your state doesn't allow you to email your completed ballot, that you can email it to the Federal Voting Assistance Program, and they will then print it and fax it to your state so that it can be submitted to your state via fax by not you, which I would argue is violating the state's requirements. But right. that's an issue for attorneys to deal with, like yourself. But in places where these ballots, because they were electronically submitted, you can't just like take a ballot and stick it in a tabulator if it's printed on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So in most cases, these ballots either have to be hand counted or they have to be duplicated so that the duplicated ballots can then be fed through a tabulator. This was the case in Maricopa County, Arizona, where they had the vast majority of their UOCAVA ballots were returned electronically. And each and every one of those had to be duplicated onto a regular ballot so that it could be tabulated. But, when you look at the votes of all of the electronic submitted UOCAVA ballots, the breakdown was 74% for Biden, 26% for Trump in the total of the UOCAVA ballots, which again was a significant difference from the 50-50 split of the general electorate of Maricopa County. So that seemed a little bit off. You know, people would argue, well, you know, military didn't support, you know, this candidate or that candidate. Again, it's just, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find sort of a breakdown, a group of people that are that swayed in one position or another. But there were other places too where, you know, you don't maybe have like the official count because most places don't report the military separately. They don't report UOCAVA separately, right? They just sort of bring it in and count it with the absentee. So when you get those results. But Fulton County, Georgia reported that they did a hand count of 950 UOCAVA ballots. And according to the reports on that, 100% of the 950 UOCAVA ballots were votes for Biden, zero votes for Trump in that 950 hand count.
And is that, and that's civilian, non-military?
No, so when the ballot comes, that's all of the UOCAVA. That's all of the UOCAVA. Because again, once the ballots are returned and they're, you know, not, they're no longer linked to a voter, you can't tell, if it was military or civilian. But this is not isolated. You know, there were reports from Louisiana poll workers, right, who were actually working the polls and doing the tabulation of the UOCAVA ballots. Mm-hmm. And they said 80% easily Biden, 20% Trump. Cobb County, Georgia, same thing. A poll worker said, wait a second, something's not right here with this thing. And then you had a Colorado judge of elections who actually wrote out an affidavit and said 95% of the UOCAVA ballots were for Biden. And again, that's just not that's such a ridiculous percentage that it really makes you question. I mean, obviously, people can have their preferences and subsets of the population favor one candidate over another. But, the idea that it's 100% or 95%, it just seems like it warrants some closer scrutiny.
So have you run across anything that would suggest to you that this was that there were fraudulent votes included?
Yeah, I mean, you can a simple search on the internet, you can find people talking about committing fraud. There's one example, you know, that we actually highlight in our report simply because, it's a this GhostSec, right? GhostSec is a fairly well-known like vigilante hacking group, right? But of course, there's no hacking required here, but they are activists, right? They're hacktivists. And they actually published online a post that said, I used the federal postcard application to commit fraud and vote in the U.S. election. And hey, you should do the same. Here's a link. Go do it. That's just one example. And so I think that if anybody was really interested in investigating and getting to the bottom of this. I mean, again, this is public records. This is all that we can do is, you know, do these searches and say, hey, look, you know, this person said they broke the law. Perhaps you could investigate that. Or, you know, at the very least, because all of these agencies agree that electronic voting, email voting is incredibly vulnerable, then I think that people on both sides of the aisle should be able to get together and say, we need to close this loophole. We need to fix this problem. There are people admitting openly online that they have used this to commit fraud, and somebody should do something about it.
Well, it's interesting because there was a time when I would have thought that I would reach out to the Election Crimes Bureau of the Department of Justice or the FBI. But frankly, I don't have any confidence that they would actually take a look at this. And it seems to me that this is something that CISA, the Center for, what is that, Internet Security? I don't know. Something like that. It's a division, it's an agency within the Department of Homeland Security. And their job, part of their job is to protect U.S. elections from foreign interference. And this is exactly the kind of thing that seems to me that is within their duty, but they're so busy pounding their chest about what a great job they did in 2020 that I don't think they would even look at this.
It was the safest, most secure. But, you know, I mean, and that's what's frustrating. You know, people want to ridicule anybody who raises any sort of concern or question. But, you know, when you can just go online and look and see this for yourself and you say, you know, where are the people that are supposed to be protecting us? Where are they? Why aren't they doing something? The technology that exists in 2020 to make sure that no voter who is entitled to vote would be disenfranchised. There's so many different things that they could do. You don't need to be able to send, you know, an email that says, hey, trust me.
I live in, you know, London when I'm really down the street.
Right. And just email me the ballot and I'll email it back to you.
Yeah. And I don't have to prove who I am, where I am, nothing. I mean, this to me is a big area that we need to make sure that somebody's watching this. And we need to make sure that that isn't allowed to impact the 2022 election.
This is an urgent matter. And the reason that this is so urgent is that these ballots, these email ballots, are going to start going out in just a couple of weeks, right? Some of them might already be going out because what the law requires is that all of these states must send them out at least 45 days before the election. So if somebody doesn't do something very, very quickly, I am just really, really concerned about what this is going to look like. We're talking 400,000 ballots, we don't know where they came from. And the Department of Defense, the agency that administers this program, was apparently shocked to find out that so many more people, you know, had participated than they expected. And keep in mind, they have access to all this data too. These are public records. I look at them, they could look at them too. They had them well before they were ever made public. So why did they not disclose this extraordinary jump in non-military overseas voting?
Well, non-citizen voting. We don't have any way of knowing.
We have no way to verify
if these are legitimate U.S. citizens or if they are hackers. And this person that you mentioned that said, hey, here's how I did it. He lives in Canada.
He's
and doesn't even pretend to be a U.S. citizen.
Right. And says, look, it's so easy. Just go download this and it is easy.
Well, that's something that we want our local election integrity task forces to get to work on.
Yeah. But again, we're sort of at the mercy of our lawmakers because the law is written to enable this. And so they have to put some safeguards into place because there's just no controls over it. And the worst part about it is, you know, because you can use a VPN, you can mask your identity. If you create an email address, you know, bob@bobsmith.com, you know, you can very easily control that and make it very difficult to investigate. So even if somebody had the will to look into this, it would be a really difficult task. And so what they have to do is urgently put some sort of controls on this, just based on the sheer issues that happened in 2020. And again, the Department of Defense seemed to have no idea that out of the blue, that number was, you know, more than double what they said it was when they
what they thought it was.
What they thought it was, what they reported in a report to Congress.
Right.
Right. It was more than double what they disclosed. And it's really alarming.
Well, all of this can be found at your website. The Uokava report, it can be found at veritivote.us. That's V-E-R-I-T-Y vote.us. And people can go and look at your report. And will you also, do you also have available on your website the state-by-state breakdown on how many of these non-military overseas ballots were cast in that in each state?
Yep, we will include that as well. But again, any person, you don't have to take our word for it. You can go to the EAC website, download the data set, and look at it for yourself, and you can see that it's just absolutely remarkable.
Well, thank you so much for all of your hard work. I mean, I just, these reports that you, these investigations and reports that you do are really, really important. And many, many of us appreciate it because we're trying to learn facts and disseminate truth and facts. And this is one of those that certainly I'd never paid a lot of attention to really in about 10 years. And I always looked at it as primarily overseas military voting with a much smaller percentage of non-military, but that has completely reversed in the last decade, and we need to know what that's all about. So thank you so much, Heather, for joining us, and thank you for all your hard work. And we'll keep coming back to Verity Vote to find out what new and alarming information you have for us. But with that, I want to thank everybody for joining our joining with us and listening to, and watching this podcast, Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. We hope that you will sign up at our website, whoscounting.us, so that you can always get the latest episode of our podcast. You can get information about what's going on in your state and across the country with election integrity, and help us save our American elections. And with that, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, and to become part of the Election Integrity Network.